who is a French scholar of Islam in the Middle East. He is one of the foremost authorities in the field. He is professor of Institute of Political Studies in Paris. He's been there from 1985 to present, to the present time. He's also the chair of Middle East and Mediterranean Studies and the director of the doctoral program Muslim World of the Institute of Political Studies. He also holds a chair at London School of Economics and Politics. Well, he speaks a lot of languages, French, English, Arabic, Italian. He's published widely, and one of his latest books is Beyond Terror and Martyrdom, published by Harvard University Press in 2008. If I go through all his works, it will take quite a bit of time, so I won't actually bother. For those of you who are interested in knowing more about Professor Kapol's works, probably would be a good idea to go to his website. It's quite a bit listed there, books, articles, book chapters and the like. He does travel a lot. He gives lectures, seminars and workshops all over the world. One of the foremost authorities on the topic of discussion tonight. We also have with us his colleague, Dr. Bernard Rogier, who is also researching on Islam in the Middle East, agency and so forth. He has been also working in this area for quite a long time. Dr. Bernard Rogier will also speak tonight after Professor Kapol's lecture. This lecture is being recorded tonight. In the interest of time, we have to keep an eye on that. We were supposed to finish by 7:30. So Professor Kapol will be speaking for about 20-25 minutes, followed by a short talk by Dr. Bernard Rogier, and then we'll have Q&A. I must also say that the lecture is being filmed. Those of you who have any particular objections to that, please let us know. I'm sure I will have a chat with Professor Kapol and Dr. Rogier later on about the filming and recording. And this is supposed to be made available on the internet. Because with great speakers, scholars and thinkers like these, it's very hard to actually get the opportunity to hear them. We're very fortunate to have the opportunity with Professor Kapol, although he's not feeling quite well. He has to leave immediately after the lecture to the airport. He made the time to come and speak to us, and for that I'm very grateful. So without further ado, let me invite Professor Kapol to speak for 25 minutes. Professor Kapol.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Naeem. I would like first to apologize for being late for two reasons. One is due to the fact that for some reason I haven't been able to walk properly for the last 3 years, so I don't know what Australia did to me, what I did to Australia. And the other one, which is a much more sinister omen, is that I was just marking the thesis, the PhD dissertation of one of my students, in my hotel room, and I stopped at the very moment when she was writing a footnote about a Salafi imam from Kuwait, Imam As-Sabt, I don't know whether you remember him, who had been invited to Melbourne by the local Salafis on a whatever tour of something, and who died in a car accident in the taxi taking him to the mosque. So I stopped out of terror and asked the cabbie to go slowly, because we professors considers that universities are our mosques for, as the time being, and still around. If ever something happens to me, I hope you'll inscribe one of the trees or one of the benches to my memory, and to that of my colleague Bernard Rougier, who, as you know, is one of the great experts on Salafism in the world today, and who wrote a fascinating book on Lebanon called Everyday Jihad. Now, thank you very much for your flattering introduction. The problem with flattering introduction is that you have to live up to the expectations they rise, and I will surely disappoint you. In the few minutes that you've allowed to me, I will try to briefly introduce what I believe is one of the key issues for the world of today and tomorrow, i.e., How does the Middle East, and we'll try to define together what we mean by the Middle East, how does the Middle East function in the multipolar world of today? As you know, when the world was bipolar, organized around the competition between the US and the USSR, the Middle East had a sort of peculiar place already, because there were some Middle Eastern countries that were allied to the Soviets, others who were close to the USA. But nevertheless, the issue of Palestine and of Israel had already made it something a little complicated. Even though Palestine, the Palestinians, and some states like Egypt, Syria, Iraq, South Yemen, Algeria, and a few others were aligned on Moscow, nevertheless, the USSR originally had played a non-insignificant role in the creation of Israel that he believed would be some sort of a socialist state. And then alliances in the region were something that led, for instance, to the betrayal of the Soviet camp by Sadat in the beginning of the 1970s, and it sort of became the locus of the proxy war between the two world superpowers of the time. Even though the Palestinian Arab question could not be reduced entirely to an East-West or to socialism, liberalism, antagonism. It was something that was much more complicated, and that in a way already defined the Middle Eastern specificity. And to some extent, at the time, what could be defined as Arab identity or Arab nationalism, as opposed to a wider-ranging Muslim identity, which was not yet translated into any political body, if you wish, it would become such later on, was the fact that Arab countries were the ones who displayed, in different tones definitely, in shades and colors, solidarity with Palestine, with the Palestinian cause. And Arab nationalism, if you wish, had undergone three stages, the first one being anti-Ottoman, against the Ottoman Empire domination in most of Arab lands, then anti-colonialist, against Britain, France, Italy, and what have you, and then against Israel as of 1948. Earlier, but as of 1948, the creation of the State of Israel. And that was something that also made the Middle East special, i.e., while most of the world was undergoing decolonization, many in Arab countries believed that the very creation of the State of Israel was counterclimactic. That it created a state that, you know, where people from Europe and from other parts of the world were coming as if it were a neo-colonialist state, if you wish. Of course, that was not at all, or this is what they said, that the view of Israelis, who on the contrary considered that it was their land that they were reclaiming, and so on and so forth. So this is up for all of you to judge on what side they stand in here. This is not what I mean to say. But I just wanted to draw your attention from the scratch to this rather peculiar dimension of the Middle East. As I mentioned earlier on, after World War II, while there was a strong Arab identity in the making and that coalesced around the issue of Israel, also around the issue of a number of wars of independence, such as the War of Algerian Independence against the French from 1954 to 1962. Nevertheless, at the time, there was no such thing as a Muslim identity worldwide that would be defined politically. There was no such organization as the Arab League that was created after World War II. And one would have to wait until 1969 to see the creation or the organization of the Islamic Conference. Something that would be helped and developed mainly by Saudi Arabia, and that was in a way an attempt by this newly powerful and influential country to make its voice heard within the realm of Middle Eastern politics. So, we are talking of a region which is at the crossroads, and as I know that we have an eminent Turkish diplomat with us tonight, at the time, would Turkey define itself as a Middle Eastern country? Well, question mark, because Mede in the ruling Turkish elite of the time considered that they were Europeans, that they were part and parcel of Europe, and that was the most important dimension of Turkish identity. Whereas nowadays, when you listen to the present leadership of Turkey and the AKP leadership, many would say that Turkey is part and parcel of the Middle East. Others would say that it's a bridge between the Middle East and Europe, and so on and so forth. So, you know, this is a sort of identity which is, which the borders of which are not perfectly to be identified. Going back to the sad anecdote that I mentioned when I began, I mean, what do we make of this Salafi imam from Kuwait, born in Palestine, touring Melbourne for, you know, whatever, a fundraising tour or what have you? Does that mean that Melbourne or the banlieues of Melbourne, this is the only word of French you still know probably that I don't have to translate, banlieue, in the old days it was champagne and parfum, now it's banlieue. In the banlieues of, pronounced with what I hope is an Australian accent, the banlieues of Melbourne, are they part and parcel of the Middle East? What about the banlieues of Paris? What about Leeds and Bradford, out of which Mohammed Siddiq Khan made his famous declaration before 7/7 2005, when with his thick Yorkshire accent, the only language he knew, and this was a guy who had passed the cricket test and who was fed mainly on fish and chips. And he said, this is war and I am a fighter, in order to defend what his friends and himself had done in land and transport. So what are the borders? Where are the borders? What are we talking about? What does the very concept, the very issue of the Middle East mean today? Some people say when they go to church to marry, I mean, in France we don't go to church anymore, we don't marry either anymore, but people would say, well, you get married for better and worse. And to some extent, the marriage between the Middle East and the rest of the world is also for better and worse. Because if we think of the Middle East, it looks like this is an area which has tremendous assets. It has tremendous assets because it has oil, it has gas, and this is centered, it's not limited to, but it's centered to this peculiar part of the Middle East, which is the Gulf region. Now we already have a problem. Am I going to call it the Persian Gulf region, and then Professor Shahram will be pleased? Or am I going to call it the Arabian Gulf region, and the representatives of the Arabian Peninsula countries will be pleased? Or am I going to call it the Gulf region, which I will choose out of sheer cowardice, and none of the others will be pleased? And the fact that you don't even know how to name it, even though the Persians, or the Iranians are in the right way, I'm trying to pay my tribute to sing for my dinner to Professor Sharam here. The Iranians are definitely in their right because this was the traditional name. But the then that means that you are dealing with a number of disputed areas. And it's not only a disputed area, but you know, when you talk about the Gulf today, you talk about oil, you talk about gas. 25% of the world's oil and gas is being exported on a daily basis through the Straits of Hormuz. And if that flow ever stops, you'll have to go cycling to the University of Melbourne 2 miles of tomorrow, miles of the day after. And then, as you all know, this is a place which is now under severe strains because of the fact that many on the Arabian side of the Gulf believe that Iran is building military nuclear capacity, and that would mean that the Gulf, instead of being a U.S. protectorate, may well become an Iranian protectorate in the future. We have not yet reached that stage. Nevertheless, I mean, this is something which is clearly perceived as a major problem for a number of actors. So there we're identifying already within this Middle East thing a first axis, a first area, a first axis of crisis, if I may say so. If we go back to what I mentioned earlier on, i.e. To the Israeli-Palestinian and then the Israeli-Arab dispute, clearly we have there another axis of crisis, an axis of crisis which is probably more ancient, which is symbolically more loaded, because identifications tend to be clearer, whether or not you're for Israel or for the Arabs, though now things are becoming more and more difficult. Are you, if you're for the Arabs, are you with Hamas or are you with the PLO? Are you with Hezbollah or are you with whoever else? And this nevertheless maintains a very strong irritant in terms of identifications worldwide and wherever you have Jews and Arabs in the world. Each community is usually using its clout and influence to lobby its own government, politicians, and constituencies to take sides on this conflict. So this is not something that can be disregarded. And also because of the ripple effects of the Palestinian, Israeli, and then the Lebanese, Syrian, and so on and so forth crisis, then this may be exported to the rest of the world. And both Melbourne and Sydney have very significant Middle Eastern and particularly Lebanese communities in which, to some extent, you see a sort of echo of the fights between the Sunnis of northern Lebanon, the Shias of southern Lebanon, and so on and so forth, and the Salafi issues, which I mentioned earlier on, and the like, to down to or up to Bilal Ghazal and his famous handling of baggage in Qantas Airways. So then we're getting closer to, I believe, what might be a definition, i.e. seeing the Middle East as a problematic place, which is extremely important because of the assets it has. We've mentioned oil. With the Arab-Israeli dispute, we mention also ancient civilizations. If we go to the rest of the Middle East and around the Mediterranean Sea, for instance, we can think of tremendous human resources, which are in short supply in Europe, for instance. As you know, Europe is an aging continent. even though the native population still is around, has not been exterminated yet. Nevertheless, it is aging. I have no idea who's going to pay for my pension. This is why I'm going to work until I die, probably. But many others are looking to the fact that people from the south might come and work and so pay for pensions. The problem being that not only is the level of education rather poor in most of those countries, but also because of the political tensions that we see in those countries, some linked to the ripple effect of the Arab-Israeli conflict, others linked to internal disputes between authoritarian regimes and civil societies, then all those problems and all those rivalries may be exported to European shores. So there again, assets and liabilities, strong assets and strong liabilities. Two identifiable axes of crisis. The most ancient one in the Israeli-Palestinian dispute in the Levant, in the eastern Mediterranean shore. The second one around the Gulf. And I would say that we now have a third one, a very significant one, that has taken shape in what is called in the Beltway the AFPAC region, something which is, of course, abominable to Pakistani ears because they do not want to be considered as the second leg of the AFPAC syntagm. They'd rather be, they are a nuclear country after all. But this is a place where the Australian army, the French army, and the rest of the NATO army, the Turkish army, are present. And they have boots on the grounds. We regularly see corpses of the French, Turkish, Australian, British soldiers coming back, though no one is really sure what we're in Afghanistan for. This is supposedly it's to restore liberty, peace, and democracy, and to fight the Taliban. The last elections in Afghanistan were not considered a model of democracy by most of the participants of the NATO alliance. And some of them are now having side negotiations with the Taliban. So this is not very clear either. Now, we could go on and consider that there are other sub-areas of conflict. But I believe that the three main axes of crisis, which I have mentioned, i.e. the Arab-Israeli, the Gulf, and the AFPAC crisis are what we have to deal with today if we want to think of the Middle East in the multipolar world, whether it be in terms of present or of future. Let's try to stand for a while in the shoes of President Obama and see how he had to deal with this issue when he took office. As you know, his predecessor, President George Bush Jr., had rather simple ideas about how to fix it. You know, it's a very American way of seeing things. There's never a problem. The issue is to fix it. So how to fix it? Well, there had been the 11th of September attacks, in the 9/11 attacks in New York. Then that asked for retaliation against the terrorists in Afghanistan, and then the sort of build-up of the so-called war on terror, the over-encompassing war on terror, that allowed for Congress and for the British Parliament, among others, to vote war credits to send troops to Iraq and to topple the Saddam Hussein regime under the pretext that Saddam had weapons of massive destruction that could strike Europe in 45 minutes, so it was said at the time. Well, we now all know that it was pure baloney. But nevertheless, this was a means to sort of an attempt to reshuffle the deck of cards in the Middle East and to try to find an overarching solution to the three systems of interrelated crises that I just mentioned. How? A, you got rid of the Taliban. And then you had this democratic Karzai state in its stead. B, you got rid of Saddam Hussein. What for? Well, he was bad. That's one thing, he was a bad guy. But also, if you got rid of Saddam Hussein, you had a new pro-West Iraq, where Shias, in their majority, as the majority population in Iraq, would be ever thankful to their American liberators. You would have a pro-West democratic Shia-based Iraq that would have a virtuous domino theory effect on neighboring Shia-dominated Iran, where Iranian civil society would rise and topple the mullahs. And also, it would teach a lesson to the Sunni countries of the Arabian Peninsula. After all, remember that 15 of the 19 hijackers of 9/11 were Saudis, and that the strong relation between Saudi Arabia and the marriage between Saudi Arabia and the US that traced back to the 14th of February, like many marriages, 1945, when on this Valentine's Day of the after-war periods, Franklin D. Roosevelt and King Abdulaziz bin Saud met aboard U.S. ship Quincy, moored in the bitter lakes of the Suez Canal, and they said those things that people say on Valentine's Day, amour toujours, i.e. My oil against your protection, and my protection against your oil, which is the basis of a sound marriage. Well, like all marriages, you know, it had its ups and downs, and 1973, 1967, but then, you know, 2001 was really a big problem, and the U.S. were not happy at the fact that a regime or a system that they by and large trusted, that had used its clout to send fighters to Afghanistan to help defeat the Soviet regime by proxy, had suddenly produced those guys who would come and bomb the towers in New York. You know. And so, building a strong Iraqi alliance, Shia strong Iraqi alliance, democratic, would sort of teach a lesson to the Arabian Peninsula. And it would also secure the whole Gulf. After all, Iraq had been out of the way since 1990, after the invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein and the first coalition that threw Saddam out but did not topple him, kept him in place, imposed embargo on Iraq, and sort of created a Gulf without Iraq as an oil-producing country, which was great for the Arabian Peninsula producers because there was a shortage of oil, so prices could be kept high. Suddenly, the reintroduction of Iraq into the oil market would, and Iraq has supposedly the second oil reserves in the world. It's difficult to know because there is no significant drilling material in function now in Iraq because of the security conditions and so on and so forth. And that, of course, would be a means to belittle the Saudis and to punish them so that they could not have their swing capacity in the oil market anymore. right? And it was also a means to teach a lesson to other allies of the US who had not really behaved well, like in Egypt, for instance, that had bred radicalism because of the authoritarian regime and so on and so forth. So you had this sort of neocon view of Weltanschauung of the Middle East, which would combine the war on terror, which was the, you know, the first drive, to the democratization process, which would be the end game. There was something in between, i.e. that you started in the AFPAC area, democratic, quote-unquote, Afghanistan. Then, through the creation of the new Iraq, the whole Gulf would be put into order. The Mullah regime would fall, Saudi Arabia would ask for mercy. There were some plans at the time of the neocons that thought that Saudi Arabia, for its endless punishment, would be divided in three: a Petrolistan on the east under the aegis of a pro-American Shia, the Hashemites coming back to take control of the holy places of Islam on the west coast, and that would be great because so the Palestinians could be put in Jordan, and that would be a solution for the Arab-Israeli crisis, the Palestinian-Israeli crisis. And then the poor Sauds would be left in the middle around Riyadh with no oil and no holy places until the sand winds would definitely get rid of Riyadh. Well, this did not take place, as you know. And but that is something that, you know, allows us to understand how the very issue of having this new Iraq was also something that would allow for leverage on the first axis of crisis, i.e. Israel-Palestine, with an Iraq, a Shia Iraq, that would not be hostile to Israel, then the Israelis would have a much bigger leverage. The Arabs, who would be deprived of Iraqi help, then would have to yield to whatever was Sharon's policy. And therefore, there would be peace after the failure of the Oslo process, a sort of post-Second Intifada peace, where what Sharon and Bush thought would be implemented, because anyway, there was no choice. Well, as you all know, those pipe dreams, if I may say so, of neoconism in the Middle East proved untrue. Iraq was the cemetery of neocon illusions. It was also, by the by, the cemetery of Al-Qaeda's illusions, because as a quid pro quo to the neocon grand narrative of the Middle East, you had the Al-Qaeda grand narrative. The first one was about the war on terror and the democratization of the region. The other one was about global jihad through martyrdom that would lead to the creation of a major Islamization of the world, if you wish. In Iraq, both felt their pain because the US invasion did not lead to, was not the cakewalk that had been predicted in the Beltway. On the contrary, and it led to a massive Sunni insurgency. Even though the Sunnis were in a minority, they felt that insurgency was doable, because as much as there was insurgency, there was no oil production, and then people had to come to terms with them. So it was not successful from this point of view. American policy was not successful. While Al-Qaeda and its ilk believed that Iraq could be a replay of Afghanistan in the 1980s, that this was a blatant case of a Muslim territory, a part of the Dar al-Islam, that was invaded by infidel troops and that would justify a universal call to defense jihad, jihad al-talab or jihad al-difa in Arabic, that was considered to be compulsory for all Muslims worldwide. You know, whether they could come and fight or whether they could pay or whether they could pray, they had to be involved in the issue. The problem was that when Al-Qaeda started to send its fighters to Iraq, well, they killed some American and allied soldiers, but they were hostage in Iraq to the vested interests of the local Sunni community. And the most, the biggest quantity of people they killed were other fellow Muslims, Iraqi Shiites. Something which, for the general public or the Ummah worldwide, was not that clear. Why would Muhammad kill another Muhammad in the name of jihad? What had imperialism and infidelity to do in that? And that led to the, you know, the Zarqawi deviation of the Al-Qaeda line, which led to Al-Qaeda having a very important moral, if we may use this word for Al-Qaeda, defeat vis-a-vis its attempt to mobilize the Ummah, Islamic Ummah, under its banner. So, dual failure. Bush administration failure, Osama bin Laden failure. Enter Obama. Obama was the, if not the only, probably one of the most significant US politicians and senators who had voted against the war on Iraq. And as you all know, he was not a typical WASP establishment person. The reason why he was elected, being a black man or a mestizo, if you'd rather, from Kenyan origin, and someone whose name is Barak, which is in Swahili Mubarak or Benedict, if you'd rather, in Arabic, Hussein, Obama, Obama in Farsi, and I'm there under, speak under your auspices, means he is with us, right? Obama. So Mubarak Hussein is with us, which is a name for an American president that has some resonance in Iran. Maybe he thought he could build on it. And so this was a sort of earthquake or a landslide in American policy. Now, what would his view of the Muslim world be, and how would he function, how would he behave? He definitely wanted to have a totally different policy than the one of his predecessor that had led to a disaster. A, he considered that the Iraqi issue was not to be dealt with militarily, i.e. that American troops were to pull out, and you know, as you know, they are to pull out significantly by the summer, I mean the summer of the other hemisphere, your winter. B, he thought that the overall support of the Bush administration to Sharon, and then after Sharon went into limbo, of Netanyahu policy in Israel was alienating the whole Arab and Muslim and third world, not only to Israel, but to America, and that had to be profoundly reviewed. And three, that if you wanted to get rid of terrorism, you had to go back to the origins of the war on terrorists, i.e. terrorists, i.e. the fall of 2001, when the American-led alliance went to Afghanistan, did not manage to get rid of bin Laden or Zawahiri or any others, but toppled the Taliban regime. But then, instead of finishing the job, most of the military effort was diverted to Iraq. So, and this was a very much a Joe Biden's idea, let's pull out of Iraq, but, you know, when we go back and see our electors, we can say that we have destroyed for good Al-Qaeda in the AFPAC area. And we will have won, if not the war on terror, at least the war against terrorism. By the same token, this will allow us to put maximum pressure on the third axis of crisis, or the first one, i.e. Israel-Palestine, and to let the Netanyahu government know that America was not backing it anymore, that was not backing the extension of the settlements, and that it was pushing for a new peace process in the Middle East. So, how did the Obama administration manage to deal in its own way, which was quite different from the Bush way, with the coalescence or the embrigation of the three aforementioned axes of crisis? Strangely enough, and this was not something that pleased the Sunni Arabs of the Arabian Peninsula, definitely, his first very significant gesture after he was elected and took power and was in January 2009, was to extend a hand to the people of the Islamic Republic of Iran, something which was new in American political parlance, on the occasion of Nowruz, of the new year, of the spring, if you wish, of 2009. What did this American extended hand policy mean? It meant that instead of looking for regime change in Iran, the new US, as his predecessor had done, the new US president was betting on some of the domestic forces of Iran to implement change and to go towards behavior change. The presidential elections were to take place, and Obama clearly showed that he favored what was to be called afterwards the Green Revolution people, after the Orange Revolution, the Velvet Revolution, the Rose Revolution, or what have you, everywhere else. I.e. that the Rafsanjanis and the Musavis and the Kharrubis and so on and so forth were the preferred allies of the U.S. in the future. That if they got rid of the Pasdaran, of Ahmadinejad, or all those people who were using their clout in Iraq through the Shia militias, and their clout in Lebanon through Hezbollah, and also to some extent through Hamas in Palestine, to push their own advantage. So if there was a change in Iran, then, you know, Iran was some sort of a key to a betterment of the peace process in the overarching Middle East. Also, Iran was interested in getting rid of Sunni radicals on its eastern border, in Balochistan and others, and to that effect, the US could help. This extended hand was not taken by the Iranian leadership, on the contrary. And in retrospect, I believe that it was not a very wise move, because it's allowed for Ahmadinejad and the Pasdaran hardliners in Iran to consider that, you know, they were in danger of death, and to mobilize all their sources to control the result of the elections, and to make sure that there would be no answer to the American offer. While Obama was playing this Obama, he is with us, policy towards the Iranians, definitely he was not very popular. in Riyadh or in Cairo. How come he was, you know, considering there again, after all, you had an American administration that considered that Shias were the solution. Bush had favored the Iraqi Shias. Now this one was into Iranian Shias. What about the majority Sunnis? And this is why I believe Obama had to go to Cairo to make his famous address to the Muslim world last June, because this was the citadel or the capital of Arab and Sunni Islam, but all the more so as his approach of Iran had failed, where he paid some lip service to Islam as the great religion, and also made of Islam an American religion, which is far more important, saying that, you know, Islam had to be perceived as one of the core religions of America. Of course, something which George Bush would not have said. And in the same time, the same breath, put pressure on Israel. So there again, you know, you see how you have a president who starts in the Gulf thinking that a more amenable Iran will be a solution for the Gulf, but also for the peace process, because if the Iranians had changed their behavior, they could have delivered on Hezbollah and Hamas, and so on and so forth. Didn't take place. And the rather harsh language, unusually harsh language for an American president that was used, and for a Democrat, that was used on Netanyahu, well, did not lead to much, as you know. Because then, on the domestic front, Obama had to deal with his health reform, with the bankers' reform, and so on and so forth. And this was all good for the Netanyahu government, because as long as Obama was entangled with his own domestic problems, and one may believe that friends of Israel in America did not really help the president on that, he could put no pressure on Israel at all, up to the slap in the face that Netanyahu inflicted on Joe Biden the other day when he was in Jerusalem and they announced in the very morning of his visit that they were extending a program of apartments for Jews in East Jerusalem. So there we have this, there again, this, in my view, this system, this Middle East system, which functions on the intricacy all those three axes of crisis. And this new American president has tried to deal with it in a different way than his predecessor, but up to now has not achieved much. And we had the Kurdish prime minister, he's a Kurd, but the Iraqi president, I'm going to make enemies now. The Iraqi president, Jalal Talabani, visiting Paris in December, and I was talking to him about his views on the American, on the Obama administration, and what he himself and his collaborators would say in Arabic was "Kullu kalam mafish tanfiz khalas," i.e., it's all words, parole, 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 but no implementation. Right. I.e., the present administration is not perceived by local actors in the Middle East as being, let alone an honest, a broker, an efficient broker. And this is, of course, creating a major vacuum. Let me end with what I believe is going to be a very important problem soon enough, which is the immediate future of Iraq. As you know, there were elections in Iraq recently, and the former Prime Minister Maliki's slate came second, even though he claims that the elections were fraudulent. And the one who came first, by a small margin, was one of his predecessors, Mr. Allawi. Then, number three, came the slate of Muqtada al-Sadr, a young radical Shia preacher, an erstwhile Iraqi nationalist, but who is now learning in Qom, Iran, how to become an Ayatollah, something which usually goes with some friendship for the host country. And then the Kurds came forth, which is a change because in the previous government, in a way, the Kurds were the kingmakers. Nowadays, they are not anymore. The kingmakers are the radical Shias, i.e., the Iranian Stooges. And this was hailed by the press as a victory of secularism in Iraq. True, when I was in Baghdad in late January, when you looked at the street scene in Baghdad, you thought that you were in Tehran or in southern Beirut, in Shia land. Flags everywhere with the portraits of Hussein, of Ali, I mean, the founders of Shiism, if you wish, the martyrdom, and you could not escape it anywhere, and it was hard to feel that this was your country if you were a Sunni, or if you were a secular Shiite. And Maliki was playing very much on it. Alawi, his rival, managed to not only to garner the votes of a number of Shiites who were not into the sort of religiosity that Maliki was boasting with, but also he had almost all of Sunni's vote for him. And he was backed tremendously by Saudi Arabia with all the means that this country has to that effect. But what may appear on the surface as the victory of Alawi, the secularist and the former Ba'athist and CIA person, has put him in a position where he is hostage, together with his predecessor, or together with the present current affairs Prime Minister Maliki, hostage to Muqtada al-Sadr, that is to say, hostage to Iranian interests. And this is taking place while American troops, who already are not visible in Baghdad, I mean, they're in their barracks, you don't see them in the street anymore, should start to pull out, leaving Iraq in a situation that may be extremely chaotic, and you saw suicide bombings and bombings in general have started again, something which is not a good omen for peace and stability in the region, which is, of course, a good opportunity for the present hardliners in the Iranian regime. How could Obama return to the polls for the midterm elections if the result of his policy in Iraq is that the country is totally destroyed, if it's more and more under Iranian influence, and so on and so forth? This is a big question. So, with this, I would like to end, to come to an end, because the issue was not to sort of make a Cassandra's talk about the future of the Middle East, but to try to bring into our way of dealing with the region the fact that this is a region that has to be taken into consideration as a place where you have different intermingling axes of crisis, and that you cannot deal with one issue without another. That you still have to invent a way of dealing with this virtually, and that both American presidents, from a rather different approach, failed to grasp it. Whereas other actors, such as, for instance, the present Iranian hardliners, have been quite astute at using that. I mean, using their proxies in Iraq, their proxies in Lebanon, and so on and so forth. Think of the so-called 33-day war of June-July 2006, where the mightiest army of the area, the Israeli army, Tzahal, was not able to overcome Hezbollah. And where, in the general situation of frustration and discontent, Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, even though he's a Shiite, was hailed in many parts of the Muslim world, which is predominantly Sunni, as the hero and the embodiment of resistance. So this was a little attempt for me to catch your attention on the way the Middle Eastern system functions today, and on the fact that the interaction between those three axes of crisis, it is what makes its difficult integration in the world system one of the big questions of the decades to come. With that, I think I should end, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Professor Keppel, for this very enlightening presentation. Unfortunately, because of time, Dr. Hajir has kindly agreed that you will probably speak on this occasion, maybe on another occasion. I don't have a lot of time. We're supposed to finish at 7:30. But I could actually allow just one question from the audience, please.
I heard recently somebody refer to Netanyahu as believing that...
Refer to what?
Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, as thinking that Israel is the last superpower in the world. Have you got any views on that? Now, not militarily, obviously, but Israel, the state, is being able to do what it likes in the Middle East.
The last superpower, I don't know, but... there is clearly something very strange that has happened of late, i.e. that in spite of America's will and of Obama's will, Netanyahu just didn't abide. Now, as I mentioned, this was due to the rather astute use by Netanyahu of constraints on the domestic front in America. That, you know, Obama was clogged with the health thing and the bankers and whatever. B, Israel feels that for the time being it is insecurity. You know, the fence doesn't allow for any suicide attacks anymore. They have destroyed Gaza after Operation Cast Lead, and they couldn't care less about whatever the reactions of Gazians, Palestinian Arabs, Muslims, the rest of the world is. Also, the Israeli economy is thriving. In the Netanyahu area, for instance, there are a number of super high-tech startups which are there selling their products or being sold to the US or wherever in the world. Something that shows that Israeli investments in brain power has now been quite successful, and it brings a lot of financial oxygen, if you wish, which does not, even though the strategic relation between the US and Israel cannot be called into question, nevertheless, you know, like as was the case under President Bush the First, who was rather successful in twisting Prime Minister Shamir's hand. He may have lost re-election for that reason, some say, but I don't know. This present president was unable to do so. Among the things, because, you know, Bush the elder had Congress refuse to guarantee a loan by the Israeli government, and that compelled it to, you know, not to pursue its settlement policy on such and such case. So it has a financial oxygen. And then, but this is a hypothesis that not everybody shares, I think, I believe that Israel has a new ally. Guess what it is? Big country. Well, you're lukewarm, but not yet hot. Russia, of course. Russia. R-U-S-S-I-A. And, pardon my French. And the, then President, now Prime Minister Putin, and erstwhile Israeli Prime Minister Sharon were quite in agreement about the fact that they were surrounded by hostile Muslims. And that in Israel nowadays, there is a very, very significant Russian constituency which has very close links to what is happening in Russia, which is extremely influential. And also, there is a lot of Russian oligarch sympathy for Israel today, for a number of reasons. So I don't mean to say that, you know, Moscow is going to replace Washington in Israeli policy. But nevertheless, I mean, Sharon and afterwards, and after him Netanyahu, have managed to broaden their international support, which had, you know, shrinked to something which was very important, that it was a one-way street, i.e. Washington-Israel. Nowadays, I mean, they don't really have a choice. It has to be America first and foremost. But nevertheless, I mean, they have some leeway to negotiate. And as you said, to some extent, even though it's not a superpower probably, it is, in the present circumstances, in the Middle East, I mean, the Israeli government has been quite able to impose its views on its protector and patron.
Thank you very much. With that, I will invite Professor Sharon to come and give the board thanks.
Thank you, Professor. I appreciate that you're in excruciating pain, so we do. We are very thankful that you have made time and effort to share with us your views on a very complex and very intriguing region and the challenges that President Obama faces now in trying to find a resolution to this really complex mix. So thank you very much for being with us. I also would like to thank the Honorable Councilor of Turkey and Councilor of Oman for being with us today. And thank you, the audience, for being so patient, waiting for our speaker to arrive and staying after time. So with that, please join me in thanking Professor Jürgen Ferrer.